Ekatra Podcast Conversations, for the curious essential knowledge, simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome back, everyone. Today, we're diving into a really monumental book. It's one that basically finished the job started by one of history's biggest scientific shakeups.
That's right. We're talking about Charles Darwin's The Descent of Man and Selection in Relation to Sex from 1871.
Yeah, and this was the one people were kind of waiting for, maybe even dreading, after On the Origin of Species came out back in 1859.
Exactly. In Origin, Darwin was, well, careful. He barely touched on humans. Just dropped that little hint, you know, that light will be thrown on the origin of man and his history.
And Descent of Man, 12 years later, is him flipping that light switched all the way on. It's his big statement on where we fit into the evolutionary picture.
Mm-hmm.
So our goal today is to give you a kind of roadmap through this huge, complex work. We really want to zero in on Darwin's two main arguments. Okay, first, the evidence, which he saw as undeniable, that humans evolved from lower forms, sharing ancestors with other animals.
And second,
the fascinating and maybe surprising role of sexual selection. You know, how the drive to be attractive shaped us, not just things like peacocks.
Right. It's not just about survival of the fittest in the classic sense.
Exactly. And why does this still matter so much today? Well, it fundamentally challenges how you see yourself, how you see humanity.
It really does. It takes things we hold sacred, our minds, our morals, even love, and says, these have natural origins too. It firmly plants us within the animal kingdom, not separate from it.
It forces a redefinition of human, really.
It absolutely does.
Now, tackling this kind of subject, I mean, it went against centuries of religious and philosophical thought. They often needed some serious credibility. Tell us a bit about Charles Darwin himself.
Well, by 1871, Charles Darwin was already, you know, a giant in science. His authority came from just decades of incredibly detailed observation and thinking.
Starting with that famous voyage on HMS Beagle, right?
Mm-hmm.
Back in the 1830s.
Precisely. That five-year journey wasn't just like an adventure trip. It was the bedrock, the empirical data for everything that followed.
And what makes The Descent of Man so powerful is that he didn't just tack humans on at the end of Origin. He spent another whole decade focused specifically on us.
That's right. He was gathering evidence from everywhere, anatomy, embryology, what we'd now call anthropology, even psychology. He was pulling all these threads together.
To fulfill that promise he made in Origin.
Mm-hmm. And that took real intellectual courage. His whole approach was materialistic, everything explained by natural causes, applying that to humans.
That meant directly challenging the idea of a unique human soul, of divine creation.
Absolutely. He was risking his reputation, social standing, everything, really, to follow the logic of his theory all the way through.
Okay, so let's get into the core arguments of the book itself. The main goal, you said, was to show we aren't exceptional, that we descended from a common ancestor with other animals, monogenism.
Yes, monogenism, a single origin for all humanity. And the way he builds the case is quite masterful. He starts with the physical body, the similarities we can see.
Right.
Then he moves to the mind, our mental abilities, even our morals. And finally, he uses sexual selection to explain some of the differences we see between sexes and groups.
And that key philosophical point you mentioned earlier, the difference between human minds and animal minds, is just a matter of degree, not a fundamentally different kind of thing.
That's the linchpin. He's saying, our intelligence, our language, our reason, it's all on a continuum with animals. We have more of it. It's more complex, sure, but it's not based on some entirely different non-physical substance.
So if it's just more, not different,
mm-hmm.
what does that do to traditional ideas about, say, a soul or unique human dignity?
Well, that's the revolutionary part, isn't it? It dissolves that sharp dividing line. If an ape can show rudimentary reason or affection, and we show highly complex reason and affection, where do you draw that line and say, here lies the soul? Darwin basically argued that the bridge is built from advanced intelligence plus long-term social living and habit. We're incredibly complex animals, but animals nonetheless.
Okay, and that leads into his second big idea, which apparently takes up a huge chunk of the book. Sexual selection. He needed something else besides natural selection.
Though. Exactly. Natural selection explains traits that help an organism survive and reproduce, you know, sharp claws, good camouflage, efficient lungs.
But what about things that seem like a liability, like that massive peacock tail?
Precisely. That tail doesn't help it find food or escape predators. It's cumbersome. Sexual selection explains traits like that. They persist and evolve because they make the individual more attractive to potential mates.
So it's about looking good, essentially.
Or winning fights for mates. He identified two main mechanisms. First, intersexual selection, which is usually males fighting each other for access to females. Think stags locking antlers. And second, intersexual selection, which is usually about female choice, females actively choosing males based on certain traits, like bright colors, elaborate songs, or displays, like the peahen choosing the peacock with the most impressive tail.
And Darwin applied both of those directly to humans.
He did, and that's where things got really radical, explaining differences between men and women, and even proposing explanations for differences between human populations, what they called races back then.
Okay, let's dig into the evidence. He starts with the physical body, arguing we carry the indelible stamp of our origins. What was his proof?
He lays out three main lines of evidence. First is homology. That's the fundamental similarity in basic structure between different species.
Like our hands having the same basic bone structure as a bat's wing or a dolphin's flipper.
Exactly. Different functions, but the same underlying blueprint. Why would that be, he asked, if each was created separately? It points strongly to shared ancestry modifications of a common theme.
Makes sense. What's the second line?
Embryology. He pointed out how early human embryos look remarkably similar to the embryos of other vertebrates.
I've heard about this, like we temporarily have structures resembling gill slits.
Right, pharyngeal arches, and a small tail structure that usually disappears, leaving just the coccyx. It's like our development briefly replays stages of our deep evolutionary past.
Wow. Okay, and the third one, you said it was your favorite.
Yes, vestigial structures. These are the parts that seem to have no function now or are even detrimental. Things like the appendix, our wisdom teeth, the tiny muscles that let some people wiggle their ears.
The tailbone, the coccyx again.
Exactly. Darwin argued these make no sense from a perfect design perspective. Why include useless or problematic parts? But they make perfect sense as leftovers from ancestors who did use them. Evolutionary baggage, basically.
So our bodies are just full of clues. But proving physical links is one thing. The bigger hurdle must have been arguing that our minds, our morality, are also evolved, not divinely given.
Absolutely. That was the core of the resistance, you could say. He spent a lot of time building the case for mental continuity.
How? What kind of evidence did he use?
He pointed to animals showing emotions we recognize: joy, fear, affection, jealousy. They show memory, attention, even simple forms of reasoning and problem solving, like using tools.
Okay.
And language, he argued, wasn't some magical human invention. It likely evolved gradually from simpler animal calls and communication, combined with our growing brain power and social needs.
But morality, conscience, yeah. The golden rule, that feels like the biggest leap. How did he explain that naturally?
His argument was that it stems from social instincts. Things like parental care, sympathy for others in your group, the desire for approval. These are seen in many social animals because they help the group survive.
So groups that cooperated and helped each other outcompeted groups that didn't.
Essentially, yes. Then you add to those basic social instincts our more advanced human intelligence. Memory of past actions, the ability to anticipate consequences, the development of language to express approval or disapproval, and the force of habit.
And out of that mix emerges what we call a conscience.
That was his radical idea. Morality becomes an evolved strategy for navigating life in a complex social species. The conscience is that internal feeling arising when our immediate selfish desires clash with those deeper, long-term social instincts.
Wow. Okay. So after tackling body and mind, he comes back to sexual selection and applies it to humans specifically.
Right. He uses it partly to explain differences between the sexes, like why males in many species, including potentially early humans, might be larger or more competitive due to that male-male combat, that intrasexual selection.
Makes sense.
But then he also uses it to explain differences between human populations or races. And this is where it gets complicated and historically controversial.
Awesome.
He suggested that many physical differences, skin color, hair texture, features, might not actually be adaptations to climate driven by natural selection.
Wait, really? So they don't primarily help survival in a particular place.
Yeah.
Then why are they different?
His proposal was that they were often driven by sexual selection, specifically by mate choice or intersexual selection. Different ancestral groups, perhaps isolated for long periods, developed different standards of beauty.
So certain traits became common in one group simply because they were considered attractive within that group, even if they offered no survival advantage.
That was his hypothesis. Female choice or mutual mate choice, acting on perhaps initially minor variations, could drive populations apart aesthetically over generations, leading to visible differences that weren't necessarily about adapting to the environment.
Like a powerful idea. Beauty is an engine of human diversity.
It is. And a very different mechanism than natural selection alone.
Okay, let's try to pull back and summarize the really big, lasting messages from The Descent of Man. What are the core takeaways for us today?
I think there are three huge ones. First, and maybe most fundamentally, the end of human exceptionalism. Darwin really hammers home that we are part of nature, not above it. Risen apes, as the saying goes, not fallen angels.
Our minds, our morals, everything connected to the animal kingdom.
Exactly. We have to accept our biological roots. That's takeaway number one.
Okay, number two.
The power of beauty and sexual selection. It's not just survival driving evolution. Aesthetics, attraction, artistry, these are potent forces too. Sexual selection explains so much of the diversity and, frankly, the beauty we see in the natural world, including aspects of human culture and appearance.
Traits that stick around because they're desired, not just because they're useful.
Right. And number three, which was actually quite progressive for his time, monogenetic unity. Despite the rampant scientific racism of the Victorian era, Darwin firmly argued that all human races descended from a single common ancestral stock.
He argued against the idea that different races were separately created species.
Correct. He countered polygenism. And based on anatomical comparisons with apes, he even inferred, quite remarkably, that our earliest ancestors likely lived on the African continent.
Providing a scientific basis for human unity, even back then.
A powerful one. Yeah.
It's a dense book, I gather. But are there key phrases or ideas that really encapsulate these arguments? Things that stick with you?
Oh, definitely. That line about our physical nature is so potent. Man still bears in his bodily frame the indelible stamp of his lowly origin. It's just so humbling, isn't it?
Yeah, like a physical reminder of where we came from. And the one about the mind.
That crucial distinction, the difference in mind, certainly is one of degree and not of kind. That just breaks down the biggest barrier people had erected between humans and animals.
It dissolves that sense of complete separation.
Mm-hmm. And then his view on morality, that it's not some mystical gift, but grounded in biology. The moral sense developing from social instincts, leading eventually to empathy and the golden rule. Morality is a natural product of social evolution.
So thinking about today, how do these century-and-a-half-old ideas actually apply to our lives now, beyond just understanding biology?
Well, the whole field of evolutionary psychology is built on this foundation. Understanding our evolved mental tendencies helps explain a lot about modern human behavior.
Like why we sometimes act in tribal ways, in group-out-group thinking.
Exactly. Those instincts might have been vital for survival in small hunter-gatherer bands, helping groups cooperate and defend themselves. But today, in our huge, interconnected societies, those same instincts can fuel prejudice and conflict. We're running ancient software on modern hardware sometimes.
That makes a lot of sense. What about the more problematic aspects? You mentioned Darwin's views were shaped by his time regarding race and gender.
Right, and that's a crucial application too. Using Darwin's own story as a lesson in critical thinking about science. He was brilliant, revolutionary, but still a product of Victorian England, and some of his social interpretations reflected its biases.
So the lesson is?
The lesson is to always question how scientific ideas are interpreted and applied, especially when they touch on social hierarchies. We need to separate the core biological insights from the cultural baggage that might get attached to them. Science needs constant self-correction.
That's a really important point. You know, here's where it gets really interesting for me personally, thinking about sexual selection driving racial differences.
Yeah.
It introduces this element of almost whimsy, not just grim survival, but what different groups found beautiful, perhaps almost arbitrarily, shaping how populations look.
Yeah.
That power of female choice or mate choice generally seems huge and maybe under-discussed.
It is a powerful counter-narrative to purely adaptationist thinking, isn't it? So what does this all mean, wrapping up? For me, the biggest lasting insight is simply continuity.
No sharp lines.
No sharp lines. Mm. Between human and animal, between body and mind, between instinct and reason, even between survival and beauty. It's all a spectrum, developed over immense stretches of time by these two forces. Natural selection and sexual selection.
We're a product of that long, messy, contingent history.
Exactly. And maybe the question Darwin implicitly leaves us with is, if our morality evolved to suit the needs of small, close-knit groups, How does that evolved morality function or malfunction in a globalized, technologically advanced world? Can it adapt?
Does our moral software need an update for the modern world? That's definitely something to chew on. Understanding where we came from seems absolutely key to figuring out where we're going.
Couldn't agree more.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.